The universe in four concentric parts. Part one, Lamia and the speech of spheres. Understood by the windmills and the turning rooftop chickens, I send spinning from my fingers the truth of mystic enumeration. The four airs perform a pantomantic, saying all in up, down, forwards, and backwards. Rise, Lamia. Say that whatever is mad in your mind's world is mad for being real. Unlovely, hungry, devourer of children, Lamia, male and female in your one negative line, nymph, satyr, ram, beetle, bitch, and cat, Lamia loves by being hungry. I perceive that devils exist only on the suburbs of insanity, that voluntary vision sees nothing, that real magic transforms within the actual. Light incites the eye to delude. The maddest thing about my world is me, supernal only by supernal sight. The winds enumerate. Pure being is the core. Around the core moves partial being. This is life. In pure being, the eye is shut. There are no judgments against matter. All exists. Nothing lacks. In pure being is creation. All is activity, and all activity produces. All that can be perceived is a created extension of the well of pure being. Dead things and inanimate things live by changing. They are extensions. They cannot attain the whole, nor could their sum produce the whole, because having no one dimension, the well can have no totality. There can be only one pure being state, because it is all, and more than all, and more than all enumerated alls. Part 2. Virago and the Obvious Real. In the unbuttoning morning, greyhound sprawls in unsubtle sleep, female nakedness robbing the wistful grace of any woman dressed in overlarge clothes. Even the lightest speech of fountains fades and seems gross. There is a hotel in Los Angeles in which a bulldog sleeps in a cradle and still looks unloved. Wild, fine, remarking hands smell of children in the very mortal tick-tock complaint of only 8 o'clock. I breathe and unwittingly conjure Virago, who is trying to bark and sleep at the same time. Outside, bombs and tennis shoes explode. Salesmen sell to other salesmen. Women sweep because they are housewives. Cats cry like babies. Spiders hide in Arctic basements. Doors slam like stomachs. Boredom slides down the streets, not bothering to wait for lights. Part 3. Incantation. If I see a tree too big for words, I shall scream and run, scream and run. If I see a tree too big for words, I shall scream and run, scream and run. Please do not touch me, please do not touch me. I will ignore your obvious cramp. I will ignore the weeds in your eyes. I will ignore your money. Give me a cigarette, light it, turn out the light. Good night, good night. If I find you dying, I will call the police. Call them all. If I find you dying, I will call the police. So just you try it, just you try. Why don't you love me? I don't believe you saw flamingos. I don't believe in China or Los Angeles. And I don't believe, and I don't believe. And oh my good, and oh my beautiful. Spirits come, but do not stay too long. Part 4. Shalom, shalom for hand and drum. Benzene, naphthalene, dexalene dream. A fog, felonious bat climbing pleated pages, Rambo bound, wound clock, spitting light on a Benny bean. Take it, make it, fly it high. Let your fingers screech in the sky. Jump with Benny, gel with tea. Haul out your hands and play with me. Ride the rock horse, downbeat, downbeat. Your nose is on my knee. Pygmalion asked, cat-sized daughter, born out of the holy half-mad, half-spine brain, I see you smiling out of your statuary chalice, eating apples, growing flowers in your flesh. Voice, we always love the mystery of you. Beetle voice, behold your trashy truce with my maker's hands. Fire in and on you for your clay and skin. I can kick children out of the mud and send a spasm into their wicked agate eyes. Voice, we love you for the mystery of hands. Imperfect Pygmalion never loathed the odorous mud out of which women were born. He never felt the rasp of sex with skin like stone, nor felt the upheaval of chalices, unmovable rock. The skin is never stone, nor love the same as love. I love the skin and only mate with stone. Voice, we are entirely fictitious, the others advance. Seraglio of graveyard golems, willow, marble, mud, and female. infuriated with the love of my unknown hands and the magical rack and the marvelous body for the first time, I have all of you transfixed in moving out of skin to stone. We give birth to buildings, hard nurseries, to stairways, bridges, benches, sidewalks, piers, prodigal with a blanched alluring caryatids and fetid venae and cat-sized holy daughter cats. More prodigal still were those medieval spires that perished in upward mystery, and then the beaches when the buildings die. Oh, my cat shape and my visionary voice, move over the rubble of ovarian platforms to the beaches of rock and half-rock, where all begins in the laughter of children kicked out of the mud and ends in the love of ectomorphic half-soft girls. The Three of Wands are the eggs, the chaos of the bird. I have not forgotten the three snow owls that I, a sleeper looking out into the midwestern winter night, saw perched on a snowbank. Now I am somewhere involved in the chaos of the polar night, and the six eyes of my first snowy epiphany glare at me from my window. Around me run carnivorous rats and lamps that fall madly from their places. Some full thing builds out of the gaze of the snow owls who sit silent and white. Some full skin thing that must be broken to let the terror out. I have a knife and I slash at the white dog at my feet. I slash to break the owls, to shatter the rats, to laugh the lamps back on the walls. What escapes from the rupture of the full skin thing is the sleeper's voice, voice robbed of mind, speech without power. The voice of the sleeper is the voice of the mouth. What is it that I have told to the snow owls? Part 2. This day was a three of angels, one flown, one fallen, one with secrets. The mouth of one is a Doric mode, a ruin, an owl of violated purity. The snowiest and flightest of the trio is the angel of white anguish glaring at me from the snow. The real queen of the snow stirs her pot in my room, torments me with charcoal, and does not tell what she knows and what I do not know. The real snow queen has the whole of the Arctic impaled in her eyes. Part 3. In the illuminated books of the 15th century, I am able to find this day's breath. In the 15th century, the hand owned the pen, and light was a part of the word. In the 15th century, my name was Marguerite d'Angoulême, an owl. In the 15th century, Poul de Lambourg shook down the apples. In the 15th century, I had an amulet and sores. Today I have seen two dogs at war in the intersection of Bancroft and Telegraph Avenues. Traffic was held up for 10 minutes and vexation was universal. 4. I cannot listen to your opera when the squares below are rocking the boat. Your beautiful rapture is turned off in the midst of its eternal aria. When the boat is launched, the tourist squares break out in speech. The first square wants to go to the ferry building to see some real live ferries. He is dropped off on Market Street to travel to the Richmond district for the best piece of ass in town. The second square, tentatively named Peter Gray, wants to go to the Black Cat because it is a gay bar. Mary Tootsie says, gay? There is sawdust on the hem of her coat. I blow out every candle in the hayloft. No one is speaking at all. Mary Tootsie, who writes poetry herself, buys three copies of Howl. Part 5. I find the Snow Queen making speeches in my bed. Her mouth is the mouth and the language of the sleeper. The ritual is endless. Part 6. Matins are held in a cathedral of trees. The wind confuses everything, the light, my mind, the sound of leaves. This is a tree I sit on, where once I sat inflamed with the name of my Snow Queen. I heard her feet breaking leaves, heard her unbelievable steps moving away, heard her reach the top of the hill, and I wanted her never to come back. The wind leaves my own lungs breathless, my mind wasting a million dripping words, my body bathed and baptized, and I am too perfect to write poems. The title of this is a quote from the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. The desire for power is the desire for flight. To have power, you must learn to fly. To have a wing is to darken something. To have love, you must learn to fly, and the love of being a wing is mystery. This poem is for a you. You because I have power, but not the power to escape you. You because you have more flight than anything born out of the air. You are the mouth that flies without a voice and speaks power. You, because you have stepped into the fire of the real. They called you the bird of devils, and out of the fire brought forth a citadel in the form of a bronze bow. They called you what was bright in the hot fire, brought out of the fire the love of the bird of devils, brought out of the isolated light the bird of birds, brought out of love what was mad in the real, and discovered themselves feathered in the wild air. The bird, in bringing forth the egg, thinks first of the sky, then of flight, and then of what flies. In the love of the sky, poems are born, and there is order in my wandering through you, finding that the veins of you are feathered on the inside, and that your blood has brought forth eggs. We, moving as we do, become order robbed of objects, become ritual. We, moving, are capable of calling to the earth the birds of containment, ritual birds. A bird in a ritual is the grave's eagle, a bronze bowl, wings embracing the universe of the belly. This is the ritual bird, saltwater sky containing one fish, a clay fish who swims in an undersea subway, a grave's fish who does not even swim, the fish that you, as a child in a yellow play suit, prodded with a stick, and when it died, asked no one, what did it just lose? The fish and the bird turn back to stare at each other, unreflecting. The space of sight between eye and eye is where all meaning becomes recognized and estranged. Beneath the bronze bird is the turtle on whose back the blind, wingless world fights and loses. A bird with dead eyes is not a bird. Its singing lies in white nets around its feet. The wreath of sightless vision bows its head against a songless, starless, moonless, endless night. Flying is not merely having wings. Here is the ritual bird, no object. Here is the urn that surrounds, and it is the surrounding and containing that creates what urns are. Whatever it is that desires power, it must be contained in the belly of the ritual bird, and swim in the sea under the enclosing wing before it can have vision. And seeing never becomes the object seen. In the crucible I see you as an old brass bird lady who paints children on her stomach. You as an old lady sit in Pershing Square, place my hand on your belly and say, he don't kick no more, must be dead. When your name was Julia and I loved you, you knew someone who painted a child on you. But the child, being genetic, halved, quartered, became visible, a fish in the internal ocean. Your name changed from Julia when I loved you into bronze, and then I swam in you. The ocean began to beat at your breasts, and your metallic pain made nights with you into merry-go-rounds. Your primordial belly made out of the fish a thing with lungs and legs, and then I wandered in you, and your name was fire. Nights with you became Gothic architecture. When the reality in your bronze belly began to have eyes, and you began to turn back to look at each other, and the holy mud of the world that would have hung between your eye and the eye of your child began to form on the sides of your bronze bowl, you, in the manner of birds who would prefer to be blind, willed death into your genesis. And the child, who then looked like an undersea Laocoon, the child died, and the bronze was shocked. It vibrated and gave forth the music of lost being. Your name was Julia without any metal. Your name was all the blood and all the veins of the world, and no world could stop the madly opening flowers of your veins, and no world could stop the weeds of my terrible love. Your name was Julia, whose death looked like the bottom of the ocean, whose blood looked like cathedral windows, whose death looked like statues, whose blood looked like wine and powdered gold, whose death looked like the cold fire of being alive and alone, whose blood looked like war, whose death looked like the unenchanted philosopher's stone, whose blood looked like the red scream of roots pulled out of the earth. Your name was dead, and all birds stopped flying. When your name was a boy, and as savage and perfect as the statue of a boy, I became the function of an urn, but an urn reversed. Within me I have felt 500,000 deaths and looked at none of them. The reversed urn, being powerless to contain, covers or cups or becomes apparently solid. Out of the fire is born light. Out of the alloy and forging, bronze bowls are made. Out of exchanged vision, the world is born. Out of a wing, flight is born. Out of all containing, now is born. In loving the fire, I have attained the fire. Loving bronze, I have killed the bronze. Loving the vision, I have distilled the earth. Loving the wing, I have become its flight.
have your name.
George Stanley, one of the poets from Jack Spice's workshop.
The sequence is for Pablito and is dedicated to Jack Spicer. Sequence for Pablito. Pablito at the Corrida. Instance found him bronzing in the fat veal country, whittling on reeds, and brought him on this suddenly silent stage. His hungry knees cried underneath the gilded starch. The little hands inside could hardly make his brain look here, look here. Then the cold horn elbowed through gasping pain into the secret eggs of him, and the stone crowd stood up and bawled. Now the brothers read louds in Spain. Raped on the shining sand, his leather-red heart pours out its criminal cache of strawberry powder. Power is an act of the many. To Pablito in the elephantine dusk, Christ was a power leaping on the wall. Would power only sleep in the blue steel, or crack from A to B for him, obedient as Christian Africa? But alas, it bowled from the bull, came off the feverish mob for his kill. Now cordons of ants would like to remove his brain. Let the judgment of headlines fall on him then. Let the hack eulogist with lead slug stamp his human wax into bloodless grace. Will anyone blame anyone for the lie? Pompeii. When I read this poem, I think of Pompeii. When they dug up Pompeii, the poems were gone, flower-like and fragile in the stone, giving nothing to the stone, honey alloyed to the stone, making nothing sweet. The eyes of the matrons burned on the dark blue walls. Under their eyes, in shallow pools, the bell of a xylophone, silver, bell of an ambulance, bell of a burglar alarm, a trying to watch the slowest of motion, a grinding explosion, change everything in the complexity of a second. When I read this poem, I know Pompeii is at hand. They were unready. It came at the wrong hour for them, the silver bell. Some little dignity argued a minute with the enclosing, and all that was left then was the gesture, virginity, the little lost dog come home leaping and leaping caught as in a cartoon. When I read this poem, I know Pompeii is imminent. I know we are moving easily into frenzy. I feel like taking off my hat to Pompeii before running. I should talk like the elder Pliny until I die, and then like the younger reporting my own death. I was too tired to go see the eruption. Besides, Uncle had set me a reading in Cicero. I read it. I bathed and took dinner. My uncle died there with a silly cocked hat on his head like a real admiral. When the wind changed, sparks began to fall. Mother and I went north. I had to carry her. Now it is beautiful weather. I am still reading. Cicero's style is most Roman of all. Dear Tacitus, my uncle died there. He died stoically, I am told. All his debts were paid. Mother and I are well. My dear Pliny, they were such nice people, the dead. We are moving so easily into frenzy, with nary a backward glance, so graciously. The silver bell will ring in the afternoon. Bell of a xylophone, bell of an ambulance, bell of a burglar alarm, and Pompeii, the dull, unconscious lurch exploding under the bay. We will be prepared, but unready. Speech will be on our lips then, light-winged, watching the light flame flowing under your flesh, translucent, becoming conscious of the dark flame, the dark red wall collapsing behind the flying soot, and your two white hands are shriveled to black twigs, unable to say, immediate, impossibly gesturing. What it is you were going to say will remain unsaid. Even the flattening words will ripple in pools of stone and die between our lips in the hardening hill. There was a time for consolation in the morning of the state. You and me, Republicans, read The Unexamined Life Is Not Worth Living. that could console us. But now we cannot get consolation from Greek maxims when everybody is licking his lips, expectant. Bell of a xylophone, bell of an ambulance, bell of a burglar alarm, silver. Now time has fallen into our hands out of all the clocks. You look to me for consolation, and the hot wind pours by unconcerned, flushing our steepled faces, and the thick flow of death winnows down the window like grass. Flowers. In a world of flowers, the enclosing is pregnant with silent clockwork and the shade with death. Nothing expires with more exhaling of life. Nothing clogs so quickly as sweetness. Nothing turns and burns the unshod foot so readily, ruinously, as the corruption of petals becoming conception in the earth. What word can stifle as well as jasmine in the throat or unsex in the thrust as sudden as gardenias? What rash can rush in the flesh contagious as the rose? Nothing so perpetuates itself, dying more stoically. Nothing leaves less taint. And their death is a lime bleeding, a green file announcing, the steel bar in a shot of gin reminding. Anything cold and cold poured on the nape of the neck, metallic, lying as prone as flowers in flowers on the huge steel unwintered earth surrounding the undying progress of the social worm. All death is denying a purpose and watching a wall, and flowers deny their purpose in pantomime, dying to prove the syllogism. Whatever dies without reason is beautiful. Whatever dies without ransom. They die without reason and are beautiful, irreproachable. Once in a violet spring, illumined by the throat of a dawn gale pouring silver from the dark blue crooks of an omega, in a cracking thunder-strewn thaw when the wild flowers poured out of the slush like crimson lava, you asked me how they grow. Does something underneath care enough for flowers to push them up? I said no, nothing under this sweet green earth pushes them up. Nothing does. Flowers were in the air, green and tentative, tendrils curling, uncoiled out of a dead man's nose, burned on the yesterdays of food. How do they grow, you asked. I said one leans on the other's shoulder. How do they die? Without reason. Hand in hand, dying, curtsying just once. And how do my bare feet come to know the death of flowers? The idiotic white joy of concrete pours on them makes no difference. Even then, the last juice winds upward once and sears everything it finds with mortality and the willingness to die. In a rational poem written by the unwounded, he is found out by the unsounded speech, irrational. In the pig's belly, the worm is eternally trying. In infected meat, your death is white and grainy. In modern poems, the transparent snake is coiled around the word, sterility in his fangs. In life, the flowers do nothing but happen. In creation, there is an earth mother or goddess, unavenged. In syllogisms, the end is contained in the promise. In action, the hand is stayed by the dream. In bed, the hand is stayed by the dream. On us, Texas can come as soon as Pompeii and more slightly. In a world of flowers, no one survives but the one who will grow like flowers, leaning with Texas and rising through the balking roar and webs of madness in the shaft of the great nomadic wind funnel into perfect silence and unequaled light, a rose. The Pompeians are all 21, their eyes wide open, with the blue bell throbbing merciless underneath. Their curse is built in repetitive font on lead. They don't need anyone to tell them how deep these grow, how deep these flowers need. No one leans to tell them. One leans on the other's shoulder. And there are flowers in the wainscoting under lead and the shade of lead, blanching. Private Rock Drouin, syrillogist of New Hampshire, tossing your hyacinth head and olive eyes for the gray coffee ladies at Little Rock. Private First Class Edmund J. Drake coughing on your ulcer in the liver and cream abuse of Beth Seda. Corporal John J. Ritterman slipping fillings out of the dental lab, smiling with your mouth full, that could not make your head into something to play as long or as loud as the loose-strung calliope at Seven Hearts or your bed into safety wherever. Lying on a GI blanket in Malvern when the beat-up Dodge came out of a forest or dream of forest, lit up like a switch engine and crashed on the embankment, and the woman looked up at you out of the spiderweb safety glass with half her face, whose sister you later married. Smashing full bottles of Falstaff on Central Avenue outside the Flamingo. Tearing open the damask in the Ohio Club with your tiny hands. Coming into my bed and demanding all my chit books, getting them. Borrowing my toothpaste, sleeping then later with Christine Page. Insisting in the Silver Dollar Cafe that your mother loved you more than mine loved me and your dad was more cruel. Writing to me finally 6 times from Tennessee until you had coaxed out the last dark heavy drop of love the Texas sand had not yet robbed and sucked it back into your white spider belly, airmail from the Brazos, and thumbed the 7 miles to Fort Campbell singing copper candy, imperishable flowers in your head. Corporal, what did you ever do for me but fill my gender with the dying kind? Give me the taste of death apples for Christmas. And as you left the room that was now a room, point out the sweating angels on the walls and name for me the syllogistic dance of flowers and point to the heavy numerology of perfection in the stars as it scattered unbanded of purpose and poured numbers endlessly on Arkansas and name for me the stages of our decay. I have heard no speech but that of these flowers, so how can I write in a poem the whole beginning torment, inching in the unwindowed passages of the womb and muttering unavenged under its breath? Death throws her bitter juice into your eyes, laughing and preening herself behind the acacia. Giggling death is an idiom of speech. Death is responsible for men plugging the holes with anecdotes, talking faster to rethread the lifeline, unable to stop the syllogism, an unquenchable flame in your pants, an imperishable flower, however fierce. Whatever lives to a purpose grows ugly. You live to a purpose. You grow ugly. And I am already irrevocably ugly behind the blinders and the new soft face, Corporal Pablito. In the blind room, in Pablito's deathbed, where the stained waxy hands of Jesus Christ writhe on the wall, Christ that was a power, in the blind light, in the arguing out of purpose that robs Pablito of his flowering, that makes him a pawn for the city desk in Madrid, that makes him a human interest death for Reuters, that consigns his blood to the filthy flowers of posters, that reminds him to girls, in the silence of our mothers, in the cessation of loud tears, in the cemetery of envisioned memorials, in the steady bleeding of Pablito, flowers are the only lives that begin to grow, flowers that fly newborn and winged as moths from our dying flesh in the black rain on US 5 when the forge at Chicago where we warmed our hands goes out for a factory and the city's despair, one by one across the continent. In the dull clank of robots, in the metal breeding of sanitary beetles, in the hollow thumping underneath the land, we are on the road. In the death of the cresting woman at her crest, the leaf goddess whose diminishing throb becomes inaudible under the scream of the new subway from the heart of the grave, in the 20th century coming on the dead, we bury them under flowers, with our tears descending and dissolving every offering, every headstone melting, we slice the lime and cover up their eyes. Nothing can stop the burning. Nothing can stop the smallness of our hearts. The land freighters rush down the concrete bend, down the inclined land to morning, hooting to morning cities, Los Angeles, Denver, their headlights mercy, and we grab a ride, and the dead lie down under flowers. This is the elegy I have written for you. The dead lie down under flowers, yet I hand you this through thin loam under flowers dampening, while the new galling rain is still mordant in our eyes, but the drop is heavy, poised, ripe with its gift, swelling, and we will never stop our dying, and we will never cease to live.
What time is it? Do you have a watch?
Jack Gilbert.
You may be interested. The workshop was run by Jack this way. He'd given an assignment. We were supposed to try to write the assignment. And one of the assignments was to create a universe. And this is what I wrote. It's called In the Beginning of the Beginning of a Poem Beginning for the Fin du Monde Man. In the beginning, there were six brown dragons whose names were Salt, 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 Baffle Bar, and Kenneth Rexroth. They were everything and identical and formless. Being everything, they lived of necessity inside each other. Being formless, they were of necessity dull. And the world was without savor. Then the fourth dragon, whose name was Salt, died, or lost interest and ceased, and anxiety came into the world. The first dragon to get worried was the third dragon, who had been originally the first dragon, and goaded by a dark uneasiness, he frantically began making things, and things came into the world. Coiling his body, he made space and filled it with elm trees and paratochlorobenzene and moons and fish called humu humu nuku nuku apua'a. But nothing would stay fresh. The elm trees bore winter. The moons kept going down. The humu humu nuku nuku apua'a kept floating to the top of the tank. And he discovered that there was no end to the odor of paratochlorobenzene. Then the second dragon and the sixth dragon decided to straighten it all out and demonstrate the right way to make things. But somehow everything kept coming out men and women, and the world was really in trouble. And the people weren't just people. They were John Charles Thomas and Mary Baker Eddy and Abigail Van Buren and Chester R. McPhee. Unfortunately. Finally, in alarm, all the dragons stopped fooling with things. But it was too late. All over the world, men were telling each other about the elms, or calculating about the moons, or writing songs about the fish. And all the women just stood around repeating over and over how they absolutely could not stand the odor of paratochlorobenzene. Moral: if you're a dragon with nothing to do, look out. I'm supposed to read a real long poem next, but it's too late, and I'm not going to. Jack will forgive me. It was called Seven Beginnings with Child and Voices, in which you were supposed to raise a spirit and kill a child. No, it's too late. So I read instead one we're supposed to write a ritual, and this one's called Abbreviated Spring Ritual for the Friars of St. Jude. When the cave is completely full, begin. Begin with the congregation singing the introit. Welcome the spring cautiously with flutes. Welcome the spring with drugs. For murderous is the spring and the April flesh of women. Welcome the spring with procedures that bind and evade. For murderous is the spring and the April flesh of women. Mangle chickens and violate the weak to appease the inescapable season of murderous spring and the April flesh of women. The waiting faces are bored. The distant butchering isn't enough, and our time must be soon. For murderous is the spring and the April flesh of women. Then the elder must enter. He will make his way toward the mahogany table at the front, pausing to do honor to each of the orders. He will do honors to the ones wearing stone belts with his hands. He will honor the ones holding bay leaves. He will honor the ones wearing iron and the ones wearing velvet. He will honor the ones holding bags of ants and the wet ones. He will honor the silent ones in crates. He will do honor to the ones without skin and the ones with Christmas trees and the ones with mirrors. He will avoid the ones with colds and the ones with the official flag of the great state of California. He will do obeisance to the black ones holding out limes. Then the elder will climb onto the mahogany table and sit in his rocking chair. Here begins the harrowing. There must be perfect silence until the sign is given. Then the ones who have been secretly marked on their back, so they may not know, are suddenly torn open amid screaming and are offered up. When everyone has been messed with the blood, the bodies are laid at the feet of the elder. Here ends the harrowing. Here begins the word. The elder will light clay lamps and place them around the body. Then, taking up the broom, he will, with his eyes closed, open the great book with the broom handle. He will read. And Christopher Smart said, "For beauty is better to look upon than meddle with." And the congregation will sing, "Timor amoris conturbat me." And Christopher Smart said, "'Tis good for a man not to know a woman. Timor amoris conturbat me." And Christopher Smart said, "They work me with harping irons, which is a barbarous instrument, because I am more unguarded than others. Timor amoris conturbat me." Here begins the prayer. O thou who hast in keeping the animal oak and the smell of night, exempt us. Timor amoris conturbat me. Thou whose might is the power of Apollo and Osiris in their summer, exempt us. Timor amoris conturbat me. Then will come the sermon and a long exulting of the congregation. If all goes well, they will begin screaming and finally race from the cave to fall on the town at the bottom of the hill. The next to last poem I'll read is called Prowl. No, it really isn't. It's really called Rhapsody. And it has an epigraph, which is from the Confessions of St. Augustine, which reads, "What pleasure hath it to see a mangled carcass?" This was to be a poem in which we were supposed to write a poem in which we appeared as a flesh-eating animal. I am old of this ravening, poisoned of their goddamned flesh, the ugly man flesh and the fat woman flesh. I am tired, sick, and old from it. But the precise addiction is unrelenting. Even now it rouses sluggishly in me, and soon the imperious iron bells will begin, and the knowledge of the next one will enter me, the realization of her walking peacefully toward our somewhere meeting. The realization will come, and the need will be on me, and I must begin again, seeking along the great river of Fillmore, or the quiet river of Pacific Heights with its birds, or the pastures of Potrero Hill, or the prairie of Sunset. Perhaps this time it will be back at the beginning, in the caves of the beach, in Vesuvio's maybe, where they come like deer, or the place where they come like ugly deer, laughing and telling me all intense how they want to experience everything. Till the shouting begins in my head, asking me if I believe in evil. Until the power climbs in me like Kong. In the morning, it will be like every morning. the filthy taste in my mouth of old clotting blood, the vomiting and the murderous stupid labor with a stupid open body. Last poem I'll read was a result. Jack took a tarot deck and passed around cards and asked us to see if we could find any meaning in the events of the week as a result of this card and use it as some sort of catalyst for a poem. The night he gave them out, I went to the beach and I found out that the one I had was the star, and I also found that that night was Walpurgisnacht, which, if you know anything about black magic, is one of the great big black magic, black mass festivals in Europe that night. And this is called Walpurgisnacht in San Francisco. Has two epigraphs. One from Wallace Stevens reads, "Eventually, an imaginary world is entirely without interest." The other is, "All things are lawful, but not all things edify." 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 23. And so I come to the final city, to the place provided on Walpurgisnacht. Taking note of the four-petaled star in my bowels, I have gone signifying after what manner it speaks within, and come to San Francisco, a continent away from New York and the beautiful mind of Mark Van Doren. A continent from Cambridge, where the marvelous 19th century lives and is improved. 3 years and almost a continent from Pittsburgh and my hegemony over the second rate. Heeding the assigned flaming star, I have come to the place, and I am suddenly tight with doubt. The damned here are so young. I sit inside the mountain of night, listening to the 12-petaled star in my heart. I sit alien and troubled by the lonely girl, striving so awkwardly to be Rambo, shouting bombos of shit, parading arrogance and new French, and locked forever in her dark tower of timid love and real genius. I am troubled by the beautiful boy, wiggling his third finger in the face of a stupid girl to punish her for abandoning Robbie's for Sausalito. The beautiful boy bitch glutting himself with smugness, facile iconoclasm, and the security of rejection, while anger and power go on 1 foot through his desolate world. I sit listening to the subtle sounds of the 12-petaled star and ponder the giant Wapiti. He sits silent among the posturing, helplessly chaste, excluded from sin. The Wapiti feeds on hate, and it becomes mint. The Wapiti persists in violence, and it becomes a kind of purity. The Wapiti sits in pain, and it remains pain. And the others, all the others. On Walpurgisnacht, I sit among amateur demons and angels and build with them a prefabricated hell. I sit miserable and false, refracted in their medium to a bloodless Virgil. Sit in a hell that burns to no end, while the flaming, thousand-petaled star of final purification burns and waves me on. Neither the variety of what one mates with nor the elaborateness of the process guarantees wisdom. Lewdness may be desirable. It is not necessarily wisdom. Desecrating middle-class shrines may be pleasant, but it takes time, and it certainly has nothing to do with wisdom. To acknowledge the dark dragons of the soul is a beginning, not a conclusion. It is not enough, this world of pretend black magic. This world of the easily bizarre is not enough. Here, painfully beyond the suburbs and the academy, It is not enough merely to break the rules, swing, or play at diabolism. If one would proceed through hell, it must be through hell, not Los Angeles. Eventually, an imaginary hell is entirely without interest.